Hey, Prime members, you can listen to The Vanished ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today.
Everybody liked him. He was a nice guy. He wasn't a mean guy. You know, he was fun to be around. He was very, you know, pleasant. He would give me anything I asked for. And so I don't know what happened. I just don't know if it made somebody mad.
So I almost feel like I was his big sister, but I also sometimes felt like, not like motherly toward him, but like a guardian type of a thing. And I just want to know. I just want to know what happened.
He gets portrayed as a bad person, and I don't like that because I know that he wasn't a bad person. I know he made some bad choices, but he never got a chance to really like turn it around. Like, I don't know, I wasn't the best person until I turned probably like 25, and that was the age that he was. And he never got a chance to like turn around and become somebody better.
On June 29th, 2013, Jamie Bryant was supposed to go to a follow-up doctor's appointment at Bronson Hospital in Kalamazoo, Michigan. The 25-year-old had previously gone to the ER to be treated for injuries he claimed he received when he fell down some stairs. The doctors wanted him to return due to the fact that his test showed some signs of pneumonia. Jamie promised to call his mom after his appointment, but she never heard from her son again. Jamie was quite a nomadic individual. He bounced from friend's house to friend's house and only owned a backpack full of belongings. So if friends and family went a few days or even a week without hearing from him, it wasn't out of the norm. However, after a long stretch of time went by and his friends had not seen or heard from Jamie, they reached out to his sister to see if he had spoken to his family. When those who cared about Jamie realized that he was nowhere to be found, they filed a missing persons report. Since that time, his family has not learned much more about where Jamie may have gone, or what could have possibly happened to him. He has not spoken to or reached out to any of his friends or family since June of 2013. He has seemingly disappeared into thin air. There have been some rumors that he may have attended a music festival on June 30th, 2013, but there's no concrete evidence to substantiate that. So where is Jamie Bryant? I'm Marissa, and from Wondery, this is episode 247 of The Vanished, Jamie Bryant's story. Audible offers thousands of popular favorites, exclusive new series, guided wellness programs, comedy, and exciting new voices in audio. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. The Audible app makes it easy to listen anytime, anywhere, while traveling, working out, walking, doing chores, you decide. I like to listen a little bit each evening while I'm cooking dinner, and it's great for my evening walks too. Recently, I've been listening to Lay Them to Rest by Laura Norton. It's a fantastic audiobook. You don't want to miss it. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/MIA or text MIA to 500-500. That's audible.com/MIA or text MIA to 500-500. For this story, we had the chance to speak with Jamie's mother, Tina. Tina was able to provide us with some background information about Jamie's childhood.
Well, when I was 17, I got married. And had four children. Jamie is number three, and I was married, four children, and divorced by the time I was 22. I raised the kids all on my own. Their father wanted nothing to do with them, so I raised them on my own. I had help with my parents, you know, and I went to work right away and just to, you know, help take care of them and raise them. I tried to do the best I could. They were my whole life. I never dated. I never had a boyfriend or anything for about 13 years until they became teenagers. So, you know, they're my whole life. And as they got older, I mean, teenagers are teenagers, but Jamie was the most outgoing and the most unafraid out of all the kids. I mean, he would venture off. He loved to play outside. He was very happy-go-lucky, very easygoing with, you know, and having a lot of friends. He loved sports. He loved basketball. He didn't like authority. He was a lot like his father. It's so funny because he and his dad look alike, sound alike, and, you know, not to ever be around him. They were just, it's uncanny. So he did not like authority.
Jamie's father was absent for much of his life, but Tina told us that Jamie was the only one out of all of her children that so desperately wanted his father in his life.
He is really the only one out of all the kids that he used to cry for a dad. When he was a kid, 10 years old, he'd, you know, come and cry, "I want a dad, I want a dad." You know, and I'm like, okay, how do I get him a dad? You know, what do we do? He was really the kid that craved that. As he got older, I think, you know, he started dabbling into drugs, and I really didn't know it. I was so naive to all of that. But when he was about 14, 15, he started getting into pot, and I didn't know until there was an accident. He was playing around with a bunch of his friends, and there was a BB gun, and it was cocked so many times that he didn't know, and he shot his friend in the tummy with this BB, and it was so pumped that it had so much force behind it that the BB went to the friend's spleen, and he had to have surgery. So at that point, Jamie was put into the juvenile system, and that's when I found out, oh, he's into drugs and stuff. So, and you know, when I really tried to keep my kids safe and sheltered, and I wouldn't let them really go anywhere or do anything, and you know, trying to keep them safe, and it still didn't work. The kids grew up in a very small town and a very small school, and you just don't think that stuff is nearby. If they want it, they're going to find it.
Around the time of this accident, Tina ended up getting married. The transition from having no father figure in his life to this new man was difficult. As previously stated, Jamie did not care for authority, and this caused conflict within his home, and he frequently butted heads with his stepfather.
I met a guy and we got married, and then Jamie, again, didn't like that authority, so they clashed, and Jamie was kind of out on his own at 17 years old. He didn't finish high school. He just went from friend to friend, had some odd jobs here and there. From 20 to the time he went missing, he lived in Kalamazoo and basically just kind of lived with a bunch of friends. You know, I'm sure he did things that he wasn't supposed to. And as he got older and as a teenager, he knew how to play on my feelings and my emotions as a mom. He was very street smart. So, you know, he knew how to survive. I know that's a terrible thing to say, but, you know, he really knew how to take care of himself out in the world. And so he just kind of drifted for many years. And, you know, I didn't know what to do. As you know, he's a grown man. All I could do was pray. He was raised in church. He knows God and had that infused in him, but he just was always looking for that easy money. You know, it's funny because all my other kids work. You know, they're all workaholics. So I don't know how. I guess he just didn't want that. So he lived from friend to friend.
By the age of 25, Jamie was shuffling around from friend's house to friend's house, but not really sure what direction he wanted to go in with his life and a possible career.
As a kid, I mean, we always talked about, you know, college and, you know, what they wanted to do with their lives. And he always said police officer as a kid. As he got older, I mean, he was always trying to find just an easy way of making money. He was really good at computers. I mean, I don't even know how he learned everything that he did about them, but he was very good at computers and understood them. And I think he actually wanted to kind of learn how to fix them. Right before he went missing, his biological father had kind of reached out to me because his dad passed away, and he works for nuclear plants. He'll, you know, he goes in and cleans them. So he travels and cleans. Jamie about get, you know, and have him come in and start doing it with him, which is funny after 20 years, reach out. And I think that's the latest thing that Jamie was into Well, right before, like I said, his dad called, reached out to me and was wanting to kind of rekindle with the kids. And I tried to, you know, talk him into it. And I think Jamie was the only one that reached out. And I think they might have had one conversation.
We asked Tina if she could walk us through the timeline of events leading up to Jamie going missing and how she learned that her son had disappeared.
The night before he went missing, he called me. He said that he fell down some stairs and that he got some, you know, busted up, scratched up, and he hurt his leg. And he went to the emergency room, and he didn't live too far from the emergency room in Kalamazoo. And they said that they saw something in his lungs and they think it might be pneumonia, but they want him to come back on Saturday to have some x-rays done. So I said, well, do you want me to come pick you up and take you home? Because at that point, I was divorced again, and my husband left me in April for another woman. I moved back in with my son, my older son, and I was living with him for a little bit to figure out what to do. And I was working in Kalamazoo, and I had to work that Saturday. Jamie called me, said, you know, I'm getting ready to go to the emergency room. Do you want to go with me? I'm like, yeah, you know, wait till I get out of work, and I'll come get you, and I'll take you. And he said, well, I don't have any money for medication. If they gave me prescriptions, I can't fill them. And I said, you know, don't worry about it. I'm going to take care of it. I'll give you some money. And again, he always knew if he ever was hungry, if he needed money, he always came to me. And I always either found, if I wasn't close by, I found a way to get him food, or I'd send him money. So he always came to me if he needed money. And I said, don't worry about it. I'll take care of it. So that was probably about 1 o'clock. And at 3 o'clock, he called me back. He said, I'm going to go ahead and go to the hospital. I said, okay, well, you know, call me and let me know what the prescription is, because you need that medication. I'm going to get it for you. And that was the last time I heard from him. And which was not uncommon, because he would call me, you know, wouldn't hear from him for weeks at a time. He'd always call me basically when he needed something. I called him about 6 o'clock. I said, Jamie, you know, where are you? I haven't heard from you. Do you need this money? And I never heard from him. And I didn't think anything of it, you know, until about a week later. And his friend through Facebook, one of his friends contacted my daughter and said, hey, how's Jamie doing? You know, I know he was sick. And she said, well, what are you talking about? He's with you guys. And he goes, no, he said he's going with his mom, and we haven't heard from him in a week. And that's when everything started rolling. And we went to the police, and they started looking into it and found his, you know, dinged his phone to figure out where he was. So he did go to the hospital that day. He left about 6:30. They saw on the cameras that he was leaving about 6:30. He didn't have a car, but when they were tracking his phone, it was going very fast off the towers, and they knew he was in a car. And I know there's a lot of talk about Jamie might have gone to the Electric Forest Fest. I didn't even know what that was. And, you know, it seems really funny, but I'm like, yeah, he might have, but he would have gotten that money from me first. He would not go up there if he needed money, he would have gotten some money from me. So I think that's highly unlikely.
We also had the opportunity to speak with Jamie's uncle, Andy. Jamie lived with Andy for a brief period of time before he went missing, and he was also one of the last people to speak to Jamie before he disappeared. Andy told us more about their conversation.
I moved to Missouri probably several months before he went missing. And, you know, he moved down here with me for a little bit. But he was telling me the day before they think that he really went missing, before he went to the hospital, he messaged me on Facebook and told me I fell down some stairs and I got to go to the doctor again tomorrow. He said he went there and they said he might have pneumonia. He was telling me he had to go back tomorrow. I told him, you know, hope you feel better. Let me know what happens. And that was really the last kind of any kind of message I got from him. And as far as that's what happened to him. But what really thought to me is he was saying he fell downstairs. And I've heard from his cousins, which my other nephews told me, they think that he might have got beaten up. He was kind of he lived on the streets and he was good at it, I guess what I'm saying. He was smart. He wasn't a stupid kid, you know what I'm saying? So he lived with me for a little bit, and I know he didn't have a father figure, and I tried to be that to him. But, you know, he still had, like everybody else, he had his problems. And from what I thought, maybe he took something from somebody that beat him up that night, and the next day, all of a sudden, he went missing, which kind of went kind of funny to me that something happened a couple of days before that. They said that that was the last ping off his cell phone and no one's heard from him since. Now, they said that's where the last place that any kind of video camera picked him up, that he was actually at the hospital the next day that he messaged me. And apparently somebody picked him up. That's what I've heard. I haven't actually seen the video.
We all know there are things in life that you have to compromise on, but when it comes to your health, there's no compromise. So don't settle for that one doctor that isn't really addressing your needs. Instead, check out ZocDoc, the place where you can find and book doctors who will make you feel comfortable. And you can even search by location, availability, and insurance. ZocDoc is a free app and website where you can search and compare highly rated in-network doctors near you and instantly book appointments with them online. Once you find the doc you want, you can book them immediately. You can filter specifically for ones who take your insurance, are located near you, and treat basically any condition you're searching for. The typical wait time to see a doctor booked on ZocDoc is between just 24 and 72 hours. That's it. I use this and you should too. Go to ZocDoc.com/vanished and download the ZocDoc app for free. Then find and book a top-rated doctor today. That's ZocDoc.com/vanished. ZocDoc.com/vanished. This message is sponsored by Greenlight. When you're a parent, you'll have your fair share of big talks with your kids. One of those big talks should involve money, and Greenlight can help with that. Greenlight is a debit card and money app for families. You can send your kids instant money transfers, get real-time notifications of spending, manage chores, and automate allowance. I've been using Greenlight with my older two kids for years. One thing that I love about it is that I can set up recurring or one-time chores, customized to my family's needs, and then my kids earn an allowance to reward them for a job well done. Not only does it motivate them to actually get the chores done, but it also teaches them a bit about financial literacy and independence. They're learning to earn, save, and spend wisely. So stop putting off the money talk and start putting your kids on the right path. Sign up for Greenlight today and get your first month free at greenlight.com/vanished. That's greenlight.com/vanished to try Greenlight for free. One more time, that's greenlight.com/vanished. We wanted to have a deeper look into who Jamie was before he went missing. So we were able to get in touch with Jamie's sister, Jackie. Jackie told us more about her younger brother, Jamie.
So Jamie, he's 3 years younger than me. So we were always like, you know, pretty close growing up. He always was like, just wanted to have fun. Kind of like a rule breaker sort of, and just kind of like wanted to do things on his own terms type of a thing.
Jackie told us about Jamie's passion for music, specifically the drums.
He was always quite different from me, though. I'm sort of like, by the rules, follow the rule type of a person. So he's always been kind of different from me in that aspect. So I just remember like having conversations with him and just like laughing because we're just so different, you know? Growing up, he was like always super into like music and the computer and like internet and things like that. Always had friends around, so he was just like super fun to be around. And but yeah, like music was, I think, was his big thing. He was in a band in Kalamazoo at the time that he went missing. He was a drummer, so that was like his big thing. I remember him getting his first drum set. He was probably around 15 or 16. He got his drum set and he like taught himself how to play. I know my mom mentioned to you that he had like a big problem with authority figures, and so when my mom got married to my stepdad, I think that was like a big thing. It was like a new authority figure in his life. And I remember my stepfather, you know, setting certain times when Jamie was allowed to play the drums because, you know, he had to sleep or whatever. He was always like super into different types of music, always downloading new songs, always listening to things with his friends. And him and his friends would record funny songs on the computer and stuff. The music was a big thing for him.
We asked Jackie when was the last time she spoke to her brother.
I talked to him the day that he went missing. And I wish I would have written the conversation down, like when I was informed that his friends were worried about him, because I thought I would remember it. You know what I mean? Like, I'm like, I won't forget this. But he called me and he was telling me that he had gotten hurt, like he fell downstairs and was going to go to the hospital or something. And that was before, I work nights. So he called me when I was getting ready for work or heading to work. And so I didn't like blow him off, but I was almost like, well, do you need me to do anything? And, you know, he said no. So I was just like, okay, well, let me know. I love you. And then it was about a week before I heard anything from his friend Thomas. He messaged me on Facebook and was like, hey, we haven't seen Jamie. Have you seen Jamie? And, you know, not hearing from him for a week was normal. He kind of like trained us to not be worried about him if we didn't hear from him for about that amount of time. And then I just remember having a second phone call, like after Jamie hung up with me that day. So I don't know if it was him or someone else who was using his phone. He thought he was calling someone else. I was like, Jamie, it's me. It's Jackie. And they were like, oh, okay. And then like hung up. So I think it was someone else using his phone. And I don't remember who they were asking for or anything, but nothing really seemed like out of ordinary for me. I didn't even think about it until Thomas, you know, messaged me. I kind of had like a feeling in my gut, but like, I didn't really think much about it because like I said, a week wasn't too long not to hear from him.
After realizing that something was wrong and no one had heard from Jamie in some time, Jackie reached out to her sister, Jody.
I called my sister, Jody, on my way to work. And I was like, I got this message from one of mine and Jamie's mutual friends. He said he hasn't seen him in a week. I don't know what to do. And I think that's when they called the police and made like a missing person report was that day. And then I called one of Jamie's, he had like several phones at any given time. He had all these different phones all the time. I called one of the numbers that I had and someone answered and I was like, Jamie? And he was like, no, this is his friend Thomas, which is another Thomas from the Thomas that messaged me on Facebook. So I was confused. He's like, no, I haven't seen him.
After Jamie was reported missing, his family jumped into action to look for him. Jackie told us about her family's search efforts to help try and find Jamie.
Mom was living in Kalamazoo at the time. So she did most of the things because I was living in Coloma and I was living kind of far away and working in New Buffalo. So I was driving all over the place. So I never spoke to the police myself. So Mom did most of the interviewing. And let's see. So that was the 8th of July that Thomas messaged me and they did the report. And then I remember we put like flyers up. We went to downtown Kalamazoo and did flyers and things on that following Wednesday, which was the 10th. And then Mom did the news report on the 12th. So it was like a week, like a 5-day span where we, you know, finally started doing things. You know what I mean?
Jackie spoke about reaching out to her sister Jody when she realized that something was wrong with their brother. We reached out to Jody and were able to interview her as well. We asked Jody about the phone call she received from her sister.
I got a call from my sister saying she got a weird message from some guy on Facebook saying that they hadn't seen Jamie or heard from Jamie in a few weeks, and they were wondering if we'd heard anything. So when my sister called me, I kind of just got like the feeling like, oh, he doesn't really want to be found. He's just doing something. So I did call the hospitals in Kalamazoo and the police stations to see if maybe he was there, and nothing came of that. And I don't know. That's the one thing I remember. I remember I was sitting at a computer and I got that call from my sister and I was just looking up numbers in Kalamazoo for me to call to try to get any answers. But like a week or so afterwards, I remember talking to my sister's husband and we were like, oh, he's probably just at someone's house and he just doesn't even realize we're looking for him. And he's going to show up and be like, well, what do you mean? I wasn't missing and it wasn't a big deal. And that's just kind of how I thought it was going to be, because there would be maybe a week or so at a time where we wouldn't talk to him. We as in my sister and I especially. So I didn't think it was going to be like this long and still nothing. I think after about 2 months, I kind of started getting a weird, bad feeling about it. And I don't know, like I was, where I was working at the time, I was working with a girl who hung out in that area, and she was just like a gossip queen anyway. But I remember her saying, telling me like, oh, she thought he was into drugs, but there was never any like solid proof of him being on drugs.
Jody also touched on the fact that her brother got into trouble when he was younger, when he severely injured one of his friends accidentally with a BB gun. Jody feels like this incident put Jamie on the wrong path.
Back when he was like, I think he was like 13 or 14, I can't really remember the exact age, but he got in trouble for shooting his friend with a BB gun, and like his friend had pumped it already and he wasn't aware and he pumped it more and he shot the kid, just being a dumb teenager. And it got lodged in the kid because it was, had been pumped so much that he got in trouble for that because the parents pressed charges. And with that, that kind of just started the downward spiral of him getting in trouble for weed. And that's where it all started. And I think he did go a while without smoking. And then after all the probation, everything was done, I think that he started smoking again because he liked it and he liked how it made him feel. And I think it calmed, like I said, it calmed him down. And then I remember another time he was in Kalamazoo with some friends and they got smoking a joint. They got caught smoking a joint outside of sort of somewhere in downtown Kalamazoo. They got caught. So he got in trouble for that. And that was when he was, I think, after he was 18.
During her interview with Jody, she commented on the fact that while her brother may have made some mistakes in life, he was still a good person and greatly loved by those who knew him and miss him.
I just feel like he gets portrayed as a bad person, and I don't like that because I know that he wasn't a bad person. I know he made some bad choices, but he never got a chance to really like turn it around. Like, I don't know, I wasn't the best person until I turned probably like 25, and that was the age that he was. And he never got a chance to like turn around and become somebody better.
Tina struggled for a long time after Jamie went missing, but she always had a great support system. Jamie's Aunt Gina helped his mother by reaching out to the detectives to find out what was going on with Jamie's case. Here's Gina discussing the measures she took to help find Jamie.
You know, with my sister-in-law being so distraught over the whole process and my husband being hopelessly away from his family and no way of helping, I said, you know, I can make some calls. And he said, do it. So I called the detective myself, the current one. And she informed me that, you know, there was the previous detective had went ahead and retired and that she inherited the case. And she seemed very nice. She just didn't seem very informed and answer questions about the case. And she's like, I don't know if you know, but we did a search like, you know, a long time ago, you know. And I said, yeah, I was aware of that. And she said that, I said, I just want to make sure he doesn't get forgotten. You know, that's my main concern. I said, you know, I know his mom's not calling you all the time just because she has a hard time accepting what's going on. But I just don't want you to think that it's not because he's not missed, because he is. And she said that, I'd like to re-interview Courtney, and I don't know who Courtney is, but I pretended. I'm like, oh, the roommate? And she said, yeah, that's it. So she confirmed that it was Courtney was the roommate. She's like, there's some information I'd like to get from him. And I said, so there's information that you're kind of withholding from us. And she said, yes. So, I mean, there's obviously some red flags there for her to be concerned that something hasn't been completed. And I'm not trying to implicate him by any means or my conversation with her was, I'd like to re-interview him. And so when I spoke with my sister-in-law recently, and I explained to her those opportunities like to possibly hire a private detective because it's been so long, you know, and she said, that's a good idea. So I called one that was in Kalamazoo. And I'm not from Kalamazoo. He goes, I live not too far from Bronson Hospital. And he said, this isn't a bad area. And this isn't somewhere he'd get picked off on the way home. And he said that this is something that my gut tells me he made it home. And like my husband said, obviously, we've talked about this extensively. You know, I mean, my only guess is truly to believe that he screwed over somebody or he did somebody wrong and they confronted him. He thought it was over and possibly he went back and it wasn't over. And because of that, he disappeared. you know, that's our guess.
Throughout the years since Jamie disappeared, his mother Tina has tried to piece together the information she has regarding her son, but it's proven to be difficult.
I have so many people that have lost children, and they're like, well, you know, we have these grief sessions. But it's different because you know where your child is. You can have that closure. I don't have that closure. I have terrible images in my mind, things that I think has happened. And it's just terrible. I mean, you know, so I don't really want to go to grief sessions with people that, you know, have that closure, that can work through that. And every day is different. I mean, one day it's just like a cloud that sticks to you. And then, I mean, it's always there. Some days it's easier. Some days you just can't get these images out of your mind. And I asked the detective, because I reached back out to, there's a new detective on the case, and I reached out to her and just to, you know, sit and talk with her for a little bit. And I think what really started all this last summer, I had a vivid dream about Jamie. And I just remember being in a house, and it had a ghost, and the ghost was pulling on my shirt. And I couldn't see the ghost, but I could see my shirt being pulled, like somebody was leading me out to this cliff off the beach. And there was a hole there, and I was supposed to dig in this hole because Jamie was there. And it was so vivid. So I was saying, well, someone needs to go get the police while I'm digging this. So at that point, I reached out to the detective. And then that's when I started, just through Facebook, and some people have reached out to me. And that's when I started to, I guess, tiptoe back into thinking about it and trying to come up with some closure and trying to, you know, get that back out there. Okay, Jamie's missing. Somebody help me. But that's what kind of started it all again. I felt like somebody was telling me to start looking again.
The Vanished is sponsored by BetterHelp. With social gatherings picking up after the winter, it can be easy to ignore your social battery and spread yourself thin. It's a good time to think about the right amount of socializing for you. Maybe you thrive around people, or maybe you prefer more alone time. Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. A therapist can help you learn how to set boundaries so you feel empowered to be the best version of yourself. Everyone can benefit from therapy. It's not just for those who've experienced major trauma. So, if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, so it's designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist, and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/vanished today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/vanished.
Everyone knows that finding the perfect t-shirt can be a challenge. I've always had problems, whether it was with the fit or quality. Luckily, the perfect t-shirt does exist, and you can find it at Skims. From cropped silhouettes to long-sleeve layering tees, there's a style for everyone. You know that I've been wearing Skims for a long time, and recently tried one of their t-shirts. It's the best fitting tee I've ever worn. Skims makes the best basics and foundations. I got the boyfriend t-shirt in Onyx, and it's so soft and comfortable. I want to wear it every day. It literally fits like a dream. Shop the Skims t-shirt shop at skims.com, now available in sizes extra, extra small to 4X. If you haven't yet, be sure to let them know I sent you. After you place your order, select podcast in the survey and select my show in the drop-down menu that follows. It's been theorized by some of Jamie's friends that he may have attended the Electric Forest Music Festival. This is a very popular music festival that takes place annually in Rothbury, Michigan. Tens of thousands of people attend this festival that focuses mostly on jam bands and electronic music. You may remember a case that we covered in 2019, Kevin Graves, who disappeared from that same festival in 2018. In 2013, the event took place from June 27th to June 30th. And Jamie was last seen on the 29th. It appeared that his phone was in a vehicle. They believe this to be the case based on how fast the pings were moving from tower to tower. Tina told us that Jamie's last cell phone ping was in the area of Delton, Michigan, which is just northeast of Kalamazoo, with Rothbury being to the northwest. This last ping was around 6 p.m., and by 6:30 when Tina made another call to Jamie, his phone went straight to voicemail. Jamie's friends believe that the festival could have been a place he may have wanted to go, since music was such a large part of his life. Could he have gotten a ride with someone to the festival? If he did go, did something happen to him there or afterwards when he would have needed a ride back to Kalamazoo? Unfortunately, there's no proof that Jamie ever made it to the festival, but it still remains a theory to this day. If you attended the Electric Forest Music Festival in 2013, it may be worth looking over your photos to see if you can spot Jamie. Tina told us what she thinks about the possibility that he attended the Electric Forest Music Festival.
He's very tall. He was very tall and skinny. So he was like 6'6", blonde hair, very skinny, just nothing but muscle. You know, he had tattoos all over him. So he was very recognizable. I mean, you know, he kind of stood out in the crowd because he was so tall. You know, everybody was thinking, you know, maybe if they saw pictures of the music festival that, you know, they could see him. But again, I don't really, in my heart, I don't feel like he went there.
While Tina believes it's unlikely that her son attended the festival, she told us what she thinks happened to her son.
I feel like somebody picked him up at the hospital. And I don't think he fell and got hurt. I think he was in a fight. He did like to fight. And I really feel like he just got with the wrong person. And I don't know. So I just feel like something happened there. Somebody picked him up and something happened. And another thing Jamie said to me, like a month before all of this happened, he, you know, and again, my mind was in just a turmoil at that time. And he said, you know, Mom, my friend, he's into heroin. And, you know, I don't know what to do for him. And I said, you know, Jamie, I don't know. All I can do is pray for him. Looking back now, I am like, was he trying to tell me something? Because he was not always truthful. And I feel like he was trying to reach out to me. And I don't know if he was telling me something about him or if he really did have a friend and he was into heroin and maybe some wrongdoing was there. I know he was just pot and he loved to drink. He loved whiskey. That I'm 100% sure of those two. Anything else, I really don't know. He hung around Kalamazoo, which it's Western University, Michigan is there, and it's the student ghetto. So there was a lot of young kids down there that he hung around with.
While we were speaking with Jamie's uncle, Andy, we asked him what he thinks happened to his nephew.
He hung around a lot of people in Kalamazoo that probably, you know, the younger generation at that time that, you know, they all live together. You know, there's a lot of drugs going around and stuff like that, you know, and that kind of stuff kind of breeds shady people. And I think that maybe, my opinion, he either took something from somebody that took a lot more offense to it than the normal person would and did something to him. I always thought that, too. I know I never seen him personally when he lived with me do drugs. But when he was kind of talking to me, it kind of like he had the symptoms of it. And I know he was depressed. You know, his family lived far away. He lived with people, I guess, from house to house in Kalamazoo. You know, different younger people, how they have these party houses or whatever, and they live there for a little bit and go on. But he kind of lived there from time to time when I actually seen him or he talked to me. The other possibility I thought that maybe he did get hooked on some kind of drug or something, some kind of drug that if he actually did have pneumonia and you take that kind of stuff when you're already that sick, you die. And the people he's with, you know, that maybe done too scared to get in trouble, you know, kind of ditch the body when he actually died instead of turning it in, which I know was a big thing around the Missouri area, to where they made a law to where you can't get in trouble if you actually report something like that happening. But I mean, back then, I don't know if that law was, you know, in place there, but I mean, that's my other opinion what happened to him. But I mean, something definitely happened to him. He wasn't the kind of kid that would just run away and never contact his mother again. He loved his mom. I know his mom loved him and she tried to take care of him, but you know, he as a teenager, had a lot of built-up anger and stuff like that, and I get it too. I was the same way when I was his age. Something happened, and you know, that's what was weird about it, that no one ever came and said anything about it. And I know he had a lot of friends that knew him in the Kalamazoo. When I was younger, when he first started living out there, I came and partied with him, and he knew everybody liked him. He was a nice guy. He wasn't a mean guy. You know, he was fun to be around. He was very, you know, pleasant. He would give me anything I asked for. And so I don't know what happened. I just don't know if, you know, if it was an overdose or if something, he made somebody mad. That it was 8 years ago, and it was very briefly. It was like a month or two. He lived with us, and I could tell he was like really going through stuff then, because he was getting angry about stuff. And I was in a bad situation. I just got out of a divorce, and that's why I moved down there, and I'm trying to get back on my feet. And you know, it was a rough time for both of us, but I mean, like I said, he lived with me. He came down here, and I mean, he would just go somewhere and people would follow him around. Like he'd make all kinds of friends out of nowhere. You know what I'm saying? I'd buy him stuff and stuff like that. And it was, you know, he was very charismatic.
Jamie's sister Jody doesn't feel overly optimistic that his case will ever be solved at this point, after so many years have gone by.
I feel like it's been so long and they haven't seemed to have any solid leads. And I feel like that area of the people he was hanging out with were small enough to the point where I think that they could have come up with something. I don't feel like they were putting their full effort into it. Kalamazoo is kind of all lumped together with Portage and Oshtemo. Like, so when people say Kalamazoo, they mean like that, those three towns. The area of Kalamazoo that he was living in was called the Student Ghetto. It was just a bunch of houses really close together that a lot of students, because it's a very big campus town, they have Western there. A lot of students would rent those houses out and have like house parties and stuff like that. And that was kind of the area that he was staying at and that he'd stayed at for years. I think he just liked to be around people.
Since Jamie has gone missing, Tina has done some research and learned about all of the missing people in her surrounding area, in the area where Jamie disappeared. It made her reflect on her younger years when her children were small, and all she wanted to do was to keep them safe.
When I got to Michigan, I was pregnant, and I had to live with my parents to start off with. And I said, okay, I'm going to live with them for a little bit, and then I'll get my own place. Well, I lived with my mom for 10 years. So my kids and I had to share a bedroom, this huge bedroom, and it's almost like the size of a small trailer, but we used this small bedroom as our little, you know, that was our, where we lived. And I had to sleep with all of my kids at one time in one big bed. And I remember just keeping them, you know, I'm going to keep them safe forever. And as they grow up and they start moving away from you and they don't need you anymore. I mean, I remember driving home from Walmart one day and like, okay, why do I have to rush home? The kids aren't there. What am I going to do with my life? And that was hard to deal with when they don't need me anymore. And then they start going out on their own, and the world is so evil. Going back to all these people that are missing, my mind can't even understand that, where these people are going.
Jamie has now been missing for more than 7 years, and with very little to go on, Tina told us what this has been like for Jamie's sisters and brother.
My youngest daughter, she just talked about it to me last summer. She finally broke down and cried. My oldest daughter, she will talk about it every once in a while and cry. And she's kind of like me. We think of, you know, the things we should have done. And then Jeremy just doesn't say too much at all. I mean, they're very supportive and they'll do anything I ask them to do. But I don't think they really worked through it. Now, my daughter-in-law, she is very supportive. And she, this past winter, we actually went to a missing in Kalamazoo. It was called Baby It's Cold Outside. It's actually for the homeless to give them clothing and gloves and things like that that they'll need for the winter, in exchange if maybe they might know some information on any of these missing people. So I went to that for the first time, and my daughter-in-law went with me. Everybody's different, and everybody just deals with it differently.
Jamie's sister Jackie told us how she's coping with her brother's disappearance today.
so loved, and he was just so funny and fun to be around. I just miss him a lot, you know, and I think I have like all these questions I want to ask him, because it's been, 2013, over 6 years? You think you're going to remember everything, but that's not the way memories work. And I want to ask him things, you know, and I'm just like, ugh, I can't, and it sucks. And that's what makes me mad, is like, because someone out there knows where he is, and it makes me so mad. It makes me so mad that they know and I don't. We all sort of have the same way of dealing with things, where we just sort of don't. Just kind of like, we push it down a lot of the time, I think. But I think sort of the same, like they want answers, and they wish we had closure. But yeah, about the same as me, you know, where they just don't really like to think about it or talk about it too much, because it hurts really bad.
Finally, we asked Tina if she had any closing words that she'd like to say about her son, Jamie.
He was also very kind. He was funny, and he would give you literally his last dollar. He would literally give me his last dollar, knowing he had no job. He had nothing, no possessions except for what he could put in a backpack. That's all he owned. When we went and picked up his belongings from the guy he was living with, it was literally a backpack and a little clothes basket full of clothes. But he was happy. I mean, that's what he wanted.
So this is where Jamie's episode was initially going to end. When we began working on this story, speaking to those close to Jamie and doing as much research as we could, everyone was under the impression that Jamie made it to the hospital on June 29th, 2013. That's what the police told his family since 2013. Back in January of this year, I put in a record request to try to gather more information about what happened to Jamie. After 8 months of waiting on records and not hearing back from the police department, I decided to proceed with Jamie's episode without them. After this episode was completed and scheduled for release in August of this year, my record request was approved. While reading Jamie's file, I learned something shocking that threw the whole timeline of events off from what we thought we knew about the day Jamie disappeared. When law enforcement first contacted Bronson Hospital, a registration clerk confirmed that Jamie was at the hospital on the 29th for x-rays. Weeks later, on July 18th, 2013, detectives learned that this initial report was an error. Jamie never made it to the hospital on the 29th. He was last at the hospital on June 28th, the day prior. So for all of these years, Jamie's family was trying to trace him from the point he left the hospital on the evening of the 29th, when in fact, he never made it there. We also learned that Jamie had been staying at a place with four other guys. While investigators were speaking with one of the roommates, John, he stated that Jamie had been staying there for a short period of time, sleeping on the couch. John told investigators that he believed he was the last one to see Jamie on the 29th, when he was leaving to go to the hospital. John said Jamie was wearing a white t-shirt and jeans. He also mentioned that Jamie seemed down because he didn't have insurance or money to pay for his medical needs. Another roommate, Thomas, said that he talked to Jamie before he left, and that Jamie had let him use one of his cell phones since he had an extra phone. Tina mentioned earlier in the episode that Jamie had come to her and said he was concerned about a friend who was using heroin. Tina has always wondered if Jamie could have been using heroin and perhaps was talking about himself. Well, according to this roommate, Thomas, he said that Jamie had been using heroin and various other street drugs. Investigators obtained a search warrant for Jamie's phone records, which showed that his last outgoing call was to his roommate, John, at 3:29 p.m. The last incoming call was from his mom at 6:33 p.m. And it was around this time that Jamie's phone was powered down. On July 10th, 2013, an investigator went to the place Jamie had been staying and got consent to do a walkthrough, but they found nothing out of the ordinary or suspicious. A third roommate, Adam, handed over Jamie's laptop and showed them his other belongings. Jamie had left behind his clothes and backpack. Adam said this was out of the ordinary for Jamie if he planned to be gone for any amount of time. It was on July 18th that they learned the information they initially had about Jamie being spotted at the hospital on the 29th was actually incorrect, and the footage of him leaving was during his visit the day prior on the 28th. Investigators began tracking down other people that Jamie had spoken to earlier in the day on the 29th. One woman said that he had called asking about pills, including ibuprofen. He stated he was in a lot of pain. Records showed that Jamie also called two pharmacies that day, along with a Walmart. They visited both pharmacies that Jamie had called, and they searched their records and stated that he had not filled any prescriptions there or any of their other chains in Kalamazoo County in 2013. On July 25th, they tracked down his roommate, John, again for further questioning. They asked him to explain what he knew about how Jamie got injured, and he said that a neighbor had brought Jamie to the house and he was bleeding. He said this occurred around 1 or 2 a.m. on the 28th. They got him on the couch where he fell asleep. Later in the day, two of the roommates drove Jamie to the hospital. According to John, when Jamie returned, he was really angry about how much his medical treatment would cost. John recalled that the next day, the 29th, Jamie left the house between 2 and 5 p.m. He said he saw him walk out the door. If you remember, I mentioned a few minutes ago that Jamie's last outgoing call was to John at 3:39 p.m. The detective confronted him about this, stating that it was odd that he would be calling him from inside the house when they were both home together. This is when John changed his story and said that he was in the town of Coldwater that day, about an hour away. Later in the conversation, John changed his story again and said that he didn't remember where he was that day. The detective asked for consent to download the data from John's phone. John denied consent, and the detective informed him that they were going to seize his phone, draft a search warrant, and let the judge decide if they had probable cause. John then admitted that he had drug-related information in his text messages, and the detective explained that they weren't concerned about that. They were concerned about finding Jamie. They also tracked down the fourth roommate, Casey. He recalled that he knew Jamie for about 4 years. They had met through the party scene as Jamie was in a band called Knuckle Babies. Casey remembered Jamie coming home injured on the 28th, and he told Casey that he had fallen off of a porch. Casey also remembered that Jamie was not happy when he returned from the hospital later on the 28th. Casey explained that he works nights, so he sleeps later, and had slept until 3 p.m. on the 29th, and then left for work around 4. He said he didn't see Jamie that day, and that no one else was home in that hour between the time he woke up at 3 and when he left for work at 4. Casey also mentioned that Jamie and one of the other roommates, John, used heroin, and that they had recently had an intervention for John. Going back and speaking with John again, he decided to change his mind and give them consent to look at his phone. What they found were a lot of text messages with other people about getting heroin, crack, powder, and pills, along with other messages from people asking about Jamie and John changing the subject. John later told detectives that he heard that Jamie had overdosed in the nearby town of Comstock, Michigan, about 15 minutes away, and that people had disposed of his body. Coincidentally, or perhaps not, the town of Comstock is along the path that Jamie's phone traveled on the evening of his disappearance. Investigators also heard back from another woman that Jamie had been calling on the 28th and the 29th, and she had very similar things to say as the other woman they had spoken to. That Jamie had been calling and asking about pain medication because of his injuries, but she didn't have any to offer. Investigators were able to obtain search warrants for the phones of several of Jamie's friends. They compared the ping information, but they weren't able to find any substantial leads there. They also obtained a search warrant for John's Mercedes-Benz. They collected evidence from the vehicle, but from the records they sent us, we can't tell if anything of value to the investigation was recovered. Finally, a person named Courtney was mentioned earlier in this story. The only notes that I could find about Courtney were that a friend of Jamie's heard that he was seen with Courtney around the time of his disappearance. This friend was speaking with Courtney via Facebook Messenger about a month after Jamie disappeared. When the person asked Courtney if he thought Jamie's disappearance was drug-related, Courtney stopped responding and the conversation ended. They tracked down the person who had seen Jamie with Courtney, and she said that she saw Jamie, Courtney, and an unidentified man walking together around the 29th. And this is where the file we received for Jamie's case ended. With all of this new information, we got back on the line with Tina and asked her what she knew about these four roommates, John, Casey, Thomas, and Adam.
The guy that Jamie was living with at the time, he had a house in Kalamazoo, and Jamie was just kind of basically staying on his couch at the time. John Dowd did reach out to me through Facebook, and he said, you know, I'm sorry. I wish I would have done more at that time, but I was in a really bad place. But nothing. I really know nothing. He let me come into his house. I didn't get Jamie's very few belongings. But unfortunately, I don't know anything about him. Now, Jamie knew a couple of Thomases, and there is a Thomas that was a very good friend, and then there was a Thomas that he did reach out to me. He was an older gentleman, but I don't think he was in a very good place. He offered to hand out flyers and stuff to Jamie. So I don't know which one is which. I'm thinking that is the, I don't want to say good and bad, but I want to say that's kind of the bad one, the one that reached out to me. And he was an older gentleman, someone I really didn't trust. But, you know, at that time I was really just reaching for straws. The other Thomas is the one that reached out to Jackie and said, hey, how's Jamie doing? I haven't heard from him in a week. He's staying with, and my daughter said, well, what do you mean? We thought he was with you guys. And he goes, no, he was sick. We thought he was with his mom.
Tina told us about a more recent interaction she had with John.
Last year, we did a little fundraiser and I raised like $1,200 and I put that on Facebook, you know, missing. If you have any information, please contact detective, you know. And then I even upped it to 5,000, but nothing. And then that's how I, you know, John Dowd came to befriend me.
We explained to Tina what it said in Jamie's file about how initially a hospital employee reported that he had, in fact, been at the hospital on the 29th. But they later learned that it was the 28th and that he had never made it back the following day.
I guess I was thinking this whole time that he was seen on, that he did go back, because Jamie contacted me that afternoon and said, do you want to take me to the hospital? And I said, yeah, I'll get out at 5, wait for me, I'll come get you. He called me about 3 o'clock and said, I'm going to go ahead and go. And I said, well, contact me because you'll need money for medication. He said, I will. And that was the last time I talked with him. And all this time, I always thought he was up, that they said, yes, he was at the hospital on the 29th. My thoughts is that Jamie was probably owed some people money for drugs, and that's how he got. I don't think he fell down the stairs. I think he was in a fight. And then I honestly thought all along he did go back to the hospital on Saturday, and then someone picked him up from the hospital and then drove him somewhere. I always thought it was either, you know, the people that he owed money to and they just killed him, or drug-related, but now I don't even know what to think.
With all of this information, we do know that Jamie was alive on the 29th, because he spoke with people over the phone. We know he told Tina he was heading to the hospital, and he called other people seeing if anyone had any pain meds. His roommate John said he saw him walk out of the house that afternoon, but later changed his story 2 more times. This leads us to wonder what happened after Jamie told his mom he was heading to the hospital. Did something transpire at the house he was staying at? Did he head out and something happened to him on his way over there? Or could he have found someone with the pain medication he was seeking and something happened there? From Jamie's file, we also learned more about his drug use that his family had not been aware of. Tina told us about her suspicions in her first interview. She wondered if the person Jamie mentioned being on heroin may have been himself. This new information confirmed her fears.
Things go through my mind, you know, the last 7 years of everything that could have happened I either thought either someone killed him or he did overdose. So, I mean, those were my two thoughts. My worst case scenario was always pot, you know, stuff like that. I don't know. I'm so naive. And the last time it was my grandson's birthday party, and that was like the end of May. And he came, you know, he was there, and that was the last time we took pictures and stuff of our family. And he said, you know, my friend, Mom, he's into heroin. I don't know how to help him. You know, now I think back, I'm like, I think he was really talking about himself. And I was in such a bad place because my husband had just left me and my life was in turmoil and I didn't even think anything like this could ever happen. So, you know, I didn't even think any, you know, I didn't even think that Jamie would be into heroin. I mean, I'm like, he's too smart to do any of that, but I was clearly wrong. Everybody's human. I know everybody has, you know, the goods and the bads. And you know, like I said, I know Jamie, and I still choose to see him as my innocent little boy. I know he was a grown man, and he was doing things that he should not have done. He still didn't deserve not to be found. I mean, that's all I really want is him to be found. That's all I want. I just want someone to step up and just let me know where he's at. At this point, I don't even care about the circumstances. I just want him home. I just want to know the truth. And I just want him home, and I just want this over and closure. That's all I really want. And I really appreciate all this information because you just think about all the things that could have happened or what happened, and you don't know. And Detective Rivard, I mean, in that couple of times I've talked with her, she said, you know, at this point it's either murder or drugs. And she doesn't come out and say that, but, you know, the way she talks, I'm just the people that Jamie hung around. You know, and I really thought the $5,000 because of the people Jamie hung around would really bring someone, oh, you know, that's a lot of money. What, you know, what could I do with this? It might just give some information out there just to bring him home. But I found out more today than I have in the last 7 years. So I really appreciate it. Yes, it's painful, but it's things I needed to know, and I really do appreciate it.
So what happened to Jamie Bryant on June 29th, 2013? We know that he told his mom that he had gone to the hospital after a fall. He let her know that he planned to return because the doctors thought he had pneumonia. He promised to call her when he was done with his appointment, but Jamie never made that call. And now we know that he never actually made it to the hospital. Because Jamie was known to go from place to place to stay, it took some time before his family was alerted that no one had seen or heard from him. By examining his phone records, investigators believe that he got into a car that evening, due to how fast his phone was traveling from one tower to the next, before powering down. We also know from various statements made by his friends that Jamie's drug use was much more extensive than what his family was aware of. We attempted to speak with the Kalamazoo Public Safety Department to get more information about their investigation, and his detective promised to speak with us, but then stopped responding to our messages. With so few leads to go on in this case, it's hard to come to any one conclusion as to what happened to Jamie. It does appear from the information in his file that investigators had suspicions about Jamie's friends and roommates, and had enough probable cause to get a search warrant for John's car. But it remains unclear if any of them were involved in his disappearance. Some people think he may have gone to the Electric Forest Festival, but there's no proof that he was ever there, or really any evidence to suggest that he planned on attending. Could Jamie's disappearance have been drug-related? We know that he was calling around and looking for pain meds on the 28th and the 29th. Could he have gone to get some medication from someone and it went wrong? Or could he have overdosed? Or what about this story that John told about hearing that Jamie had overdosed and was dumped in a nearby town? Or could Jamie have gotten into a car with the wrong person? For Jamie's family, they desperately want answers and hope someone will come forward with the lead they need to solve this case. It has been many years with very little information to go on and no new leads coming in. If you have any information about the disappearance of Jamie Bryant, please contact the Kalamazoo Public Safety Department at 269-337-8139.
And I feel like someone out there knows something and they're just not coming forward. Kalamazoo, like, I get anxious going to Kalamazoo now because it could be anybody there.
And, you know, we've come to the conclusion, and obviously after all these years, that we have to accept that he is more than likely almost 100% gone. But that doesn't mean that, you know, we don't deserve answers, that my sister-in-law doesn't deserve answers, that his siblings and his nephew and all of us don't, you know, my husband, his family and our family, you know, they deserve answers and they deserve to put him at rest. But we're hoping that time passes and somebody told somebody something that could lead to finding him.
I knew my son. I mean, I know he wasn't an angel. I know his faults. I know what kind of life he was living. I know he was into things he shouldn't have been. I probably know he was doing some sort of illegal activity, but I still love him and I still want him found. He doesn't deserve to not be found. And we, as a family, we need that.
That brings us to the end of episode 247. I'd like to thank everyone who spoke with us for this story. If you have a missing loved one that you'd like to have featured on the show, there's a case submission form at thevanishedpodcast.com. If you'd like to join in on the discussion, there's a page and discussion group on Facebook. I'm on Twitter at thevanishedpod and also on Instagram. If you enjoy this show, subscribe now and leave a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you're listening right now. Do you want to help support the show? There are a couple things that you can do. One way to help The Vanished is by supporting our sponsors. You can find links and promo codes in the episode notes. Another way to support the show is by contributing on Patreon, where you can get early and ad-free episodes. Join me next time. I'll be covering a case from Kansas. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to the small town of Chinook, where faith runs deep and secrets run deeper. In this new thriller, available exclusively on Wondery Plus, religion and crime collide when a gruesome murder rocks the isolated Montana community. Everyone is quick to point their fingers at a drug-addicted teenager, but local deputy Ruth Vogel isn't convinced. She suspects connections to a powerful religious group. Enter federal agent V.B. Loro, who has been investigating a local church for possible criminal activity. The pair form an unlikely partnership to catch the killer, unearthing secrets that leave Ruth torn between her duty to the law, her religious convictions, and her very own family. But something more sinister than murder is afoot, and someone is watching Ruth. With an all-star cast led by Emmy nominee Sanaa Lathan and Star Wars Kelly Marie Tran, Chinook is available exclusively and ad-free on Wondery Plus. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.
It's all a lighthearted nightmare on our podcast, Morbid.
We're your hosts. I'm Alina Urquhart.
And I'm Ash Kelly.
And our show is part true crime, part spooky, and part comedy.
The stories we cover are well-researched.
He claimed and confessed to officially killing up to 28 people.
With a touch of humor.
I'd just like to go ahead and say that if there's no band called Malevolent Deity,
that is pretty great.
A dash of sarcasm and just garnished a bit with a little bit of cursing.
This motherfucker lied
like a liar.
And if you're a weirdo like us and love to cozy up to a creepy tale of the paranormal,
or you love to hop in the Wayback Machine and dissect the details of some of history's most notorious crimes,
you should tune in to our podcast, Morbid. Follow Morbid on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to episodes early and ad-free by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.